3, 2, 1.
Intros.
Introduction.
Introductions of the podcast.
This is the official introduction to...
Brad, you know what this interview made me think of? And made me realize it's maybe possible again. I had started to abandon the idea that I may be able to get an honorary college degree without going to college.
Oh.
Which is one of my goals in life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, anywhere too. Community, doesn't matter. I want some institution to just give me an honorary degree without having to take like intermediate algebra.
How about School of Rock?
No, a real one. An institution of note.
Okay.
So when we're doing this interview, I'm thinking and I'm like, wait, Joe Gittleman does have a college degree. Mm. And now he's a professor in Northern Vermont. I looked at his class schedule. But what made me think of that was he said he has hired people he knows as like adjunct professors
yeah.
to teach other classes about music and stuff.
There you go.
And I'm like, you know what? I'm only 40. There's still a road here. Like a bunch of people I know are probably going to get old, go into maybe academia. And who knows? Maybe a door is going to open. So I had kind of thrown this out. And now the interview with Joe has got me back into maybe... being able to receive an honorary college degree.
Professor Horowitz.
I mean,
to the podium.
Sounds right, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds perfect.
Excuse me, Professor Horowitz.
My father's a Professor Horowitz for a long time. Makes sense.
It sounds good. It sounds good.
It does.
I back it.
It does. All right. So you think it's actually possible, or is this a pipe dream?
I think anything is possible if you put your mind to it.
Oh, thanks, Brad. You're great. There's something I got to come clean about, too, in the interview that I hid from Joe.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, I had to ask him about, like, the Clueless thing. Because to a child my age, like, that was very iconic. The fact that the Mighty Mighty Bosstones were in this, like, super contemporary pop culture movie, you know? Like, it was a big deal at the time. And I remember being excited about it. And as, like, a shitty... you know, self-righteous little punk rock kid, I was mad at Dickie for crowd surfing in the movie. I was like, dude, that's our thing, man. Now all these fucking Alicia Silverstone fans are going to be crowd surfing it. And you know what?
And they were.
I might have been right.
You were right.
Because it did. The door opened after that. And it sure did.
If it hadn't been Dickie, it would have been somebody.
Exactly.
So
soon enough, it would have been someone way less cool with way less cred, you know, because it's not like you can be like, oh, look at this poser crowd surfing. You know, I can imagine he was like head walking on people in the early 80s in Boston, you know,
yeah,
from the sounds of it.
Hell
so,
yeah, dude.
I'm not going to say shit to him. Oh, shit. Sorry. Maybe I just did. But
well, my confession is that from the moment that I started considering booking Joe for this.
Yeah.
Which is like, whatever, like a week out. Lean on Sheena would not leave my head. Every time I'm like doing dishes, man, or whatever, like that song is in my head because I wasn't bullshitting. He gave me this CD like before it came out and I went and saw those guys play with like Transplants and I think Lagwagon at Irving.
Uh-huh.
It was a great show. And I really am an Avoid One Thing fan. And like,
oh yeah!
As soon as I think of Joe Gittleman, that's what I thought of. And sure enough, like every moment it's in my head. It's so fucking catchy, that song.
It is like a perfect song.
Yeah,
it's so good, and it gets me so worked up every time. Yeah, he's a genius with that stuff. So I gotta talk. Do you know about the like random Mighty Mighty Bosstones Gaslight connection?
I do
that
not.
Happened?
No.
So it. You know, as we discussed in the interview, the Bosstones were one of my first real, like I said to Joe, one of my first introductions to like heavy music that wasn't like metal or grunge.
Right.
You know, I didn't really have a sense of like punk and hardcore yet. I was starting to get adjacent. I mean, I was little. I was like 11 or 12, you know?
Mm.
And, you know, I heard this band and I'm like, holy shit. And it was such an iconic band to me. And then years and years later, you know, we're in LA and we're recording 59 Sound with Ted Hutt, who, you know, through conversation and stuff like that, we discover is, you know, like these close personal friends with the Bosstones. And, you know, of course, Dickie was out there at the time because of, you know, the late night show. Mm-hmm. And Joe Sirois was out there. So we had this part in a song. I don't remember whose idea it was first. I mean, it's probably either Brian or Ted's. And they're like, well, you think Dickie would do backups? And we're all like, no, no chance. It's Dickie Barrett. He's not going to come on our record. And sure enough, he did it. And he's the one doing those great backups on Patient Ferris Wheel on that record. So as if it wasn't cool enough to have Dickie Barrett on my album, then we had this idea to, you know, intro a song with a car starting the song Old White Lincoln. And guess who happened to be there that day was Joe Sirois with his classic car. I don't remember what it was, something real cool, 60s or 70s. He's outside of the studio. And we went and recorded his engine turning over for the beginning of Old White Lincoln. So the Mighty Mighty Bosstones are all over the 59.
That's pretty seven. Awesome. Well, we're in the same club because Dickie sang on a Clowns record too.
Wow. Look at that.
Yeah.
So we really are. We're like super fans.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
We're not usually unified super fans of an interviewee. Right?
I mean,
you don't like anything really that was recorded after like 1978.
But let me tell you, like the Bosstones having toured in a, like they say, 12 guys in a van were the best band you could ever go on tour with. Because
is that right?
Oh my God. Those guys took us on a couple of nothing huge. I think we did like a 2 week and then like kind of a long weekend tour with them.
Okay.
And then some shows here and there. But like those guys, at the end of every show, they threw us their day room keys. So like those guys, for those of you who don't know, when you're
huge.
In a tour bus,
it's huge.
You always get like one or two hotel rooms when you get into town just to like to take showers in, essentially, because everybody sleeps on the bus.
Yeah, it's a shower room.
It's a shower room. So like we would get these,
and an internet. It's also an internet room now.
Right, right.
It used to just be a shower room. Now it's like a shower room / internet cafe.
So yeah, so these guys, you know, we'd be in whatever like town and they'd still have keys to these rooms that they'd gotten at like 10 o'clock in the morning, and the beds hadn't even been slept in.
Oh yeah.
So we would get two rooms for like, there was probably four of us. I think there was three in the band. Oh. And then a merch guy.
So you like each got a bed?
Yes, it was such luxury, dude.
Cushy. Goodness.
And since we're openers, we didn't have to make it in, you know, anywhere the next day. Like yeah. We fucking were the last to sound check.
So you were hitting like hotel pools, Continental Breck.
It was so cush. And we didn't we weren't paying for the rooms. We got, you know, if it had been us, we would have got one room and had one guy on the floor or whatever, you know.
Huge.
But, oh, no, they were so fucking.
That's huge.
Just the best. They were the best. Took us on some some really cool shows too. I mean, this was when, you know, Impression was all over radio.
Yeah, so they were like the height of their powers.
Dude, we were playing like arenas, like hockey arenas upstate.
So cool.
It was brilliant.
Well, hearing the story too, I mean, you know, how deep they all, you know, especially Dickie and Joe go back into the, you know, old school Boston scene and where they came from and stuff. It's, I don't know, it's a great story. They worked for it. They had something unique and they saw it through and it became... It's the same as I think I mentioned it with Murder by Death last week. It's like if anybody does anything remotely like this, they are just biting off the Bosstones. Everybody knows it, you know?
Yeah.
And in order to be that kind of band, it takes gumption, you know? You have to like have a unique vision and see it through. So all the credit in the world.
They worked their ass off too.
Hell yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to the interview with Joe.
I'm doing good.
It's been a minute.
Since Dickie's birthday, probably.
Yeah, so I haven't seen you in, what, 6, 7 years that was?
Is it probably 5, 6, 7 years.
Man, those shows are so much fun.
Yeah. It was cool. It was so great that you guys were able to jump on that.
I had a funny memory from that show, too, because I had to, you know, like, I don't know if you all dealt with it since you're so hometown, but, you know, the backstage was sort of in like the municipal complex.
Mm.
And it was
City
really
Hall.
Yeah, the like right City in City Hall, like in the bowels of City Hall. So already I felt like, I just don't feel comfortable in places like that. You know, I've been like a punk rocker too long. I think someone's out to get me. Uh-huh. And then I walked back and half of the staff was just slamming pizza back there. In our little curtain area.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, there's plenty of pizza. Like, enjoy. You people seem very nice. And I actually took my stuff and left. So I have no idea. Like, I think we actually set up a party for the employees of the show that night.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So anyway, for the, this was, there's this, I don't know what it was called. There was this annual kind of like food beer thing taking place in Boston City Hall Plaza, and we've been asked to play it a number of times, but one year we're like, well, maybe we could do it and kind of rebrand it as something else, and so
right.
They were nice enough to let us do that, and so whatever the event had been called for 20 years, that year was called Dickie Barrett's 50th Birthday Bash. So,
yeah.
It was amazing that you guys were able to do it. Me and Benny actually did all that. It was kind of a, you guys had another gig, if I recall, sort of that had just gone on sale or something. You had to reschedule something that was in the neighborhood or something. But
I don't recall that at all.
Well, I recall because I recall it was at Higher Ground in Burlington. I recall because I'm buddies with the guy who booked you there, and I had to go to him with my hat in my hand saying, hey, you know that Gaslight show? And because me and Benny were kind of scheming on the side about seeing if we could make it work.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Because it was probably some bullshit radius clause or something, right?
Yeah. Or, I think that you just rescheduled the date and it was all good as far as I know.
I love the Higher Ground as well. There's a spot you can get Vermont maple syrup right in the front parking lot, you know? Come on.
Yeah.
So what's going on with you, Joe?
I'm just hanging out. I'm in, I live in New Hampshire now. I still teach up in this music business program up at Northern Vermont University.
Yeah.
In Vermont. And, you know, been doing what you guys are doing. A lot of just trying to keep your sanity and do creative things during all the, you know, all the stuff that's been going on. And so
how was your teaching? How stunted was it? And did you have to like convert to virtual and stuff like that, like everyone else?
Spring of 20, we went virtual, but fall of 20 and spring of 21, we were face to face. But
oh, that's good.
That kind of came with a mix. You know, there were some students that were in quarantine and just joining via Zoom, and it was sort of like some in the classroom, some on the Zoom, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of challenges or whatever, but dude, tough to find anything to really complain about.
Right.
To be honest with you.
Yeah. If you're alive and kicking and working, it's all a bonus, right?
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, the start of the lockdown was really the start of the writing that led to our record that we put out on Epitaph not so long ago.
Was it like the impetus to write?
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, cool.
You know, me and Dick were talking and it was all kind of going down, and I don't know, I think we were both just feeling a little like, you know, what are we going to do with this time, or feeling a little bummed out about things in general, and we just, you know, put our minds to it and started doing a ton of writing.
Well, how's that work these days for you all? Because I know, I mean, obviously you started the band well before the days of sending files and stuff to people, and you had to actually either get together or ship a demo or, you know,
play things over the phone.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like how have you all transferred over into that, and are you full on digital overlord now?
Well, you know, various degrees, you know.
Right.
At the high end, our guitar player Lawrence has like a nice studio. He lives in Atlanta now.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, I just do demos in GarageBand and stuff, and me and Dickie kind of bounce things back and forth, and he has some ridiculous little app on his phone that lets him cut vocals and stuff. So we figure out a way, and you know, he sends me lyrics. And
what's the app called that he uses?
I have no idea.
He records on his phone.
I can tell you it sounds like shit. he's always in some like empty storage space cutting vocals, you know?
Just to get the idea.
That's all it ever is, you know. We're never gonna do anything with that stuff. It's just kind of like getting ideas together, you know.
Aside from the digital aspect, is the songwriting process for you all pretty similar to the beginning?
You know, I honestly, like, since the 90s, we had been kind of working this way. Everyone kind of had a home studio and, you know, we'd get together and bang ideas out, but they kind of exist. The songs kind of exist by the time we're together in a room, you know?
Right.
So it was nothing new for us. And, it was definitely cool to have something to put our energy toward. And, you know, we started talking with Epitaph and ended up going out. It was actually June of 2000 that I flew out to LA, and you know, everything was pretty well shut down at that point.
But
we got in the studio and, you know, we made it happen, you know, some sharing files around with Lawrence, our guitar player, but for the most part, the core of us were all in the studio there for, you know, a month, 6 weeks or whatever it was.
And how did Tim Armstrong get involved in all of it this time?
Dickie called Brett. You know, it's not the first time we've talked to Tim and Brett about the idea of doing things together. You know, the timing just wasn't right or whatever, for whatever reason. But it's always been something that has held some interest for us. And so when Dickie reached out to Brett, and I think he probably shared some demos or something, or basically, you know, said we're excited about the music we're working on. And Brett said, well, let's talk to Tim about it. Like Brett really wanted it to be a Hellcat thing, because when we were speaking to him about it last time, which was probably, who even knows when, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that was sort of the plan, you know. And, you know, the idea of working with Tim seemed really cool to us. It was, we had an opportunity, our longtime producer, Ted Hutt, and Tim Armstrong co-produced the record, and Tim has this killer young engineer, TJ, and Tim's got a great studio, and it was, you know, it was an awesome vibe, just like you'd think. And there are opportunities for Tim to pick up the guitar, and it was great, you know.
Yeah.
It was cool to work together, for sure.
I had heard in another interview that it might have been Dickie, but he was crediting and Out Came the Wolves with almost giving you all a license to to write real songs and to write, you know, songy songs in the 90s and not have like punk rock guilt about it.
There's a lot of songcraft there in that record, obviously.
Yeah, no, those two Rancid records, I mean, Let's Go and then Out Come the Wolves, you like, as an adult, I think I just used to be excited when they were out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was a kid and Let's Go was like one of my first summer driving around in people's cars, skateboarding kind of records. You know, I just wasn't listening to music like that.
Yeah.
And then I got older and I'm like, oh shit, like these are fucking songs and like songs on songs on songs, because you have two great melody makers and also the bass is like almost like its own thing in that band. Those records age well, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's incredible. But I remember when it came out, I was living in Central Mass at the time, and I had to drive to the mall, probably a half hour away or something. I kind of lived in the woods to find a copy of that. And I remember it was just me. I went to the mall and I got it on cassette, and I went in the car and I put it in, and I listened to it twice in the car before I even went home.
Really?
Like it was that important. Yeah. You had to sit. Like you had to pay attention. But I was really excited about it, because when we were filming a video for Hell of a Hat on the Question the Answers record in,
yeah, yeah.
in New York. And we invited Tim and Lars were in town. And I don't know how they knew we were there or whatever, but maybe we ran into them and invited them. They came by. Lars ended up being in that video, a little cameo thing. But they had a portable DAT player with them. At the time.
Wow.
And like headphones. And they were like, they were excited. They're like, check out this new record. And
I didn't even know there were portable DAT players.
Dude, they probably scarfed that from Sony. I remember seeing those guys when they were in town acting like they were going to sign to Sony. And I talked to somebody later and they were like, oh, yeah, they bailed on Sony, but they made off with a ton of fucking gear.
That's probably where it came from.
They like raided the Sony like storeroom. That's totally that's where funny. It came from, dude.
Well, I hope that's not going to cause a problem for those fellas. No,
I don't think so.
I think the statute of limitations is probably passed.
Yeah.
I think Sony's was probably a little more upset about them not signing the contract. But I actually have a Sony portable DAT player up in my attic somewhere. I remember I bought it in Japan one time when we were on tour.
Nice.
But so I had heard a couple songs. I had heard a couple mixes. And I was like, wow. You know, it was really exciting to hear those tunes. And so I was like highly anticipating. So when it came out, I just couldn't leave that Solomon Pond Mall parking lot until I listened to that record twice.
Right.
Dude, they were writing that record on the road when we were on tour with them. I remember hearing those guys work on those tunes on the road. It was like, it was the Let's Go tour and they were writing everything for the Wolves. And it was pretty epic. You could tell they were going to make good songs.
Man. It's a pretty next level moment in terms of our thing, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I guess it took a while for some artists to sort of unapologetically, you know, write songs. And it was almost like the effort was to go the other way, right? Like if you were too melodic, you had to do something weird to stay like counterculture or something.
Yeah.
Do you think without that, like, you know, them, not without them specifically, but a bunch of different bands kind of paving it that way, you think that sort of led to, you know, the mid to late 90s for you all, like where you really had just these great, 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 almost like not pop songs, but I mean, they read like pop songs because they're so catchy.
I don't mind the word pop, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Good. It's certainly not an insult for me.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly was. It was, a sort of blueprint in some ways of what you could do with just sort of writing sort of straight ahead, simple songs, you know?
Yeah. Now it's interesting. Like if you don't mind going way back with me,
because
Joe, you got to remember, like I'm a Boston's fan.
I don't really know that. I don't know that. We've really talked about it.
Like even to set the ground, like my brother was like, he wasn't a punk, but he was like a punk adjacent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And him and his friends towards the end of high school started going to City Garden shows in Trenton.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And they used to go to see you know? Uh-huh. And at the time, some other strange bands, like they're really into 311.
Uh-huh.
They're really into that band Live, who wasn't big yet because they were from Eastern PA. And, you know, they're into those bands. But that was my literally don't know how to party, I think. It could have been my first introduction into like non-metal heavy music.
Mm-hmm, cool.
You know? And I was a huge fan. And then, also when I was 16, I had started putting on shows and met H2O.
What are you, 18 now?
22. And the first, I can almost credit the Mighty Mighty Boston's with my lust for wanting to be a musician in some ways. Cause I was in a band called Dilemma and I had started putting on shows in New Jersey and I started booking H2O. I actually booked their first show in New Jersey at a fire hall by my house.
Mm.
And so it was like the first, like Toby was like the first person I knew their number and could like ask for a favor. And they were opening for you at the Trocadero in Philly.
You're right.
And I got on the list. I got backstage. It was like the first time I got to like watch a show from the backstage and see how it played out. And I even that night slipped Dickie a dilemma demo.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Now I'm remembering the story.
I'm sure he has it in bronze, you know, on his wall at his house. And it didn't go to Roadside Records in 1996.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no. So, yes, I am a Giant fan.
That's cool. I always think of you as like a hardcore kid.
Yeah, I was. But Boston's were hardcore friendly. Like, you were allowed to be a hardcore kid in like the Boston's.
Yeah.
But I never abandoned it fully, you know? Like, there was never a time through my punk rock years you wouldn't have me admitting I love Metallica, I love Nirvana, I love Led Zeppelin. Like, I'm just a fucking rock and roll fan, you know?
Yeah, cool. That's great.
But the thing I want to go back on was, you know, when you read about the history of the Boston's, the thing I can't tell where you went from A to B is, you know, you're in Gangrene. Dickie's in Impact Unit. And somehow when you met, you veer away and essentially like invented a genre from two bands that had nothing to do with that genre. So how the heck did that happen?
Well, those time, you know, the time I was in Gangrene was some years after Dickie was in Impact Unit. But basically, Dickie had his band Impact Unit. I never saw them. I probably met Dick toward the end of that. You know, he was kind of out of that. If anything, he was starting up his band, the Cheapskates, by the time I knew him. And the Cheapskates really were more Boston's kind of, it was a ska, hard drinking punk band kind of a thing. And one of the guys from Gangrene was in the band, but the thing that you people don't probably realize is, you know, the Boston's were together before I was in Gangrene. Boston's were together when we were in high school.
Right.
I was, we opened up for Fishbone. We did two shows at this little sandwich shop that Dickie worked at called Jonathan Swift's in Harvard Square.
Wow.
And we got the gig because Dickie worked there making sandwiches. But this was Fishbone's first trip to the East Coast. I want to say it was 85 or 86, but I could be wrong about that. That was an amazing moment for us, sort of seeing Fishbone. Because, I mean, what we were trying to do, like, we didn't really have many references for what we could do or how, you know, what you could achieve kind of playing ska music or whatever. But of course seeing Fishbone was a pretty eye-opening experience. But, the thing I would say about it is Boston's, we practiced in the basement of our first drummer, Josh Dulcimer, who played on, the Devil's Night Out record. And he played on half of More Noise. Joe Sirois replaced Josh halfway through the making of the More Noise record, which probably spread across 6 months. Like, we were doing it in chunks or something. what was I going to say about that? We're practicing in the basement. I remember we were playing around, like, what are we going to be? What are we going to do? You know, I don't even know if we had horn. I don't know if we had horns yet, you know, but it was kind of like we were writing these songs, and some of Josh's friends from high school would come down and like listen to us practice and stuff. And I remember like the very first time, like, we ever got any feedback on what we were doing. There was this, these sisters, Jen and Stacy Leonardi were their names, but, we were playing songs and then like after we were done, they're like, oh, I really like that one song where like you were like playing that like kind of like mellow ska jam and then just like breaks into that loud punk thing or something, you know? And like, we were just throwing shit against the wall at that point, you know what I mean? But that was the first time that like anyone ever sort of responded positively to the idea of like scotch taping together ska and punk music, you know?
Right.
So that would have been probably 84, 85.
Do Jen and Stacy Leonardi know the impact they had on a genre of music?
I don't think so. I don't know. I haven't seen them since. Like, right. I'd say no, they have no idea.
Well, hopefully they're going off track listeners. What do you think, Brad?
Yeah. Of course they are.
Probably. Yeah, of course they are.
Millions.
Right.
So we were just trying to do shit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And have fun doing it. And it was fun to have people respond, and people seemed to be responding to that kind of hybrid. So it just made us want to write more songs like that, I guess, you know?
And it seems so ambitious, especially now that, you know, you all were in high school. How do you put a horn section together and stuff like that when you're still in high school?
Yeah, that's a good question. So our first, our sax player, Tim, who you guys know, who's still in the band and was our first horn player. Dickie knew him. He had been in a hardcore band called, what are they called? I don't know what they were called. But he was from the Vineyard, and he had a buddy named Tim Bridwell who played trumpet. And so anyway, you know, those guys knew Dick, and they just sort of were like, yeah, we'll play. You know, it was just, when you start a band, you never really think anything through. It's like, what are we going to do today?
Right.
Kind of a thing, you know? And so today leads to, hey, you guys want to do this next time, next week or whatever. So zero, no real ambition, you know, to play in a room with people. We had some sense that that was our goal. Because all of Dickie's friends were giving us the shows, we tended at that time to play a lot of bars. You know, we were playing 21 plus shows.
Right.
And with really sort of mixed results, to be honest with you. Like, those people couldn't really make heads or tails of it. And it wasn't until we signed to Tang Records and started playing all ages shows. You know, one of our first all ages shows, we opened up for Slapshot at the Channel.
Nice.
And that was sort of like in that moment, like suddenly, like the sort of frantic energy of what we were doing kind of came back at us, you know, like it was the kids. It was going to be the kids that appreciated the Boss Tones. And so that sort of changed our direction a little bit. And we started playing exclusively all ages shows.
Nice.
That was our thing from then on.
And opening for Slapshot in Boston, was that like the pinnacle band to open for at the time?
Those shows were great. You know, there were always great shows at the Channel. You know, Slapshot was an exciting band to watch for sure.
Because to me, you know, when I was coming, I always saw the old Boston hardcore scene is pretty rough and kind of rough and tumble crew. Like, is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, like people have different sort of, when they think about the Boston hardcore scene, they think of like the context can vary greatly, you know, like,
you
talk to the Dropkicks about the Rat and they're talking about the, you know, the 2000s or 99, mm-hmm. you know, somewhere in there. I don't know how long they've been, but they opened up for us on tour in 97. So maybe their first shows were 96 and stuff. We didn't really play the Rat that much, the Boss Tones, handful of times. We definitely did, but, for us, you know, me and Dick and going to shows there, it was more of like an 80s thing, you know? Like,
right.
When I roadied for bands when I was in high school, and that was sort of my introduction to how shows worked and all that kind of stuff. I worked for the band The Outlets, which had Rick Barton, who was the original Dropkick Murphys guitar player. I roadied for a band called the Del Fuegos that kind of had a little bit of success in Boston. Yeah, that's right. Orkboy, he's a writer now, and you know he wrote a Tom Petty book not so long ago.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Oh, dude, I gotta look that up.
Unless I'm thinking of, I think it was him. Who else? Treater Wright. That they were Morphine. You know the band Morphine, Mark Sandman, Morphine.
Sure,
yes.
Sure.
So before Morphine, there was a band called Treater Wright, and I was a guitar tech, and I drove the van and that kind of stuff. And I just loved being around music. I wasn't really, you know, being in a band wasn't always my focus. It was just sort of like, how can I be around music and, you know, have this be my life at that time. And I had no plans of going to college or anything like that. So I just wanted to tour. And so when I graduated in 86, let me see. This band Gangrene asked me to go on tour as a roadie. And so that was the day after I graduated high school, I got in the van and went out to LA, and, you know, they played with a bunch of great bands and played shows with the Adolescents and just a lot of those shows at Fender's Ballroom and stuff. And, you know, it was a crazy time to be an 18-year-old kid on your first tour.
Sure. You know? And what was your background like that by the time you were, in the end of high school, you were, you know, already fully committed to, you know, no college and doing the music thing. And how'd you get so steadfast on that path, like so early?
That's a good question. Well, one thing I'd say is, my parents, though, they both went to college. They also were artists.
Oh, okay.
Photographers, and I grew up pretty hippie.
Okay. Grew up in Boston proper?
Cambridge.
Okay.
Cambridge, Mass. Yeah, they're divorced early. My dad lived in Watertown, which wasn't far away. And so I think, certainly from my mom, especially, I got a lot of encouragement,
Okay.
She was super supportive and like rented this little garage next to our house in Cambridge.
Oh, dope.
And that we could run an extension cord from our house sort of down the block and through this little vent in the roof, like, 'cause it had no power at all,
Right.
And that was our first little practice space,
Cool.
And so, with a mom like that, I guess how can you go wrong?
Right.
I grew up, it was all very progressive, private, sort of really small, 100 kids in a K-8 school. We all sat on the floor and played with puppets.
Oh, okay.
That was like our English class.
Oh, you were like, this is like pretty old school for that kind of stuff too. That's cool.
Yeah, it was super, super sort of leaning forward. Certainly Cambridge, as far as that kind of open classroom, progressive education, whole child kind of whatever.
Right, right.
Whatever the theories are, I don't really know, to be honest with you.
But, oh, I'm on them now. I'm doing full-on hippie parenting at this point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good.
Was your mom a proper 60s hippie?
I guess so. Interesting. I mean, she had a interesting life. My, her parents were, screenwriters in Los Angeles, but also communists. So, during the whole, blacklisting McCarthy era stuff
thing, yeah.
McCarthy thing. So they split and went to Mexico.
Whoa.
And so my mom and her brothers and sisters grew up in Mexico for a good chunk of their lives, and so she would have gone to college from there. There's always been that sort of creative artistic thing running through the family. And so I felt supported in doing that, at that time, and I guess it worked out pretty good.
That's awesome. It's almost in your blood.
Yeah.
It's in your blood to be a counterculture revolutionary type.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you feel like you've filled those shoes? I think you did well, Joe.
I think so. I hope so. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. But that you mentioned morphine. Is that how you hooked up with Paul Caldery so early on?
We knew him before. So Paul produced our very first record, Devil's Night Out.
Right.
And we recorded that whole record in 24 hours.
Whoa.
Mixed and everything.
Cool.
Yeah. Crazy, huh? How could you do that now?
Well,
you'd have to force yourself.
Yeah.
But at that point, it was all driven by just the budget,
Right, exactly.
So Paul was just the one of the engineers at one of the studios in Boston, and however we ended up getting connected with him, and he ended up doing our next record too. And then we started working with him and his partner Sean Slade. They're a production duo that did a lot of kind of cool.
Those guys were monsters in the 90s.
They did the whole Live Through This record, and they did, a bunch of sort of significant records of the time. Paul worked on Pixies recordings and that kind of stuff, and we're still friends to this day. I mean, as recently as Paul produced my Avoid One Thing record that I put out, whatever it was, a few years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Cool. So he's still in the area and doing good work. Doing it from home, though.
Right. A lot of people,
he's got like a little Neve sidecar at home, and he can do killer mixes from his living room or wherever it is.
Wow. I'm still on this. I'm hooked on this 24-hour recording session. That is,
yeah.
I mean, it is so, I just got out of the studio from something, and one of the conversations I had with the engineer was, I was shocked to find out that literally most bands just record part to part now. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll literally like do a verse and stop and do a chorus and stop. Wow. And like,
Jesus,
you know, and I was feeling a little, self-conscious because there was a few songs. I'm like, I don't know every beat I'm going to play to these songs yet. Like, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I got there and I kind of realized, like, I guess this day and age, you can kind of let it go a little. Uh-huh. It's scary, but yeah. I think there's going to be, or I think there already is kind of this like pushback happening. Mm-hmm. And I think you're seeing a lot of young people really finding the value in like live recording and open mm-hmm. recording. It seems like it's making a comeback, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, yeah. Hey, Joe, since you brought up that first album and since you're talking about live recording, Benny, mm-hmm. Maybe my favorite Boston song of all time is on that record, which is A Little Bit Ugly, mm-hmm. which sounds very live. But like, how did that song come about?
Oh my God. Well, that song is actually like, there's a splice in there on the two track on the half inch or quarter inch or whatever. Nice. It was.
Can you hear
Oh dude, where it goes from slow to fast. Right? I mean, yeah, listen to the snare drum, like change pitch. Like, but yeah, so for whatever reason, like we had started to record, there was an earlier version of that, Little Bit Ugly song. And then, we wanted to like spruce it up some and Murphy's Law was in town the day that we were going to finalize the record. They were playing at the channel and a matinee. And I knew those guys cause I had been, in Gangrene, right. You know, we played shows together and stuff. And Dickie knew them too, for another set of reasons, just having to do with like the kind of early days of, you know, the '80s, early days of Boston, New York hardcore, like, violence and stuff.
Right. You know? Oh, right. Yeah.
Like the New York guys would come up to Boston and just fuck shit up, you know?
Right.
But so they knew each other too. But we went to the show, brought them down and, you know, just with this idea of like, wouldn't it be cool if we could get Jimmy and Dickie to sing this song together? And so the slow part of the song was recorded with Jimmy that day and the fast part was recorded some other time. I don't even know. Really? And yeah, I mean, that was the thing is like, we didn't have the money in our minds. Like we thought we were just like, we're trying to be, you know, just trying to be frugal. Right. Like we can't afford to record the whole song. Let's just record half the song. And then, you know, you're doing edits just with tape and a reel of quarter inch or whatever it was. And like trying to get it right. And I remember when we put it, the whole thing together, me and Dick were listening to him, like neither of us really were completely satisfied. I think we might have scrounged up another $50 worth of studio time and gone and tried to like put some elements over that pasted across both sides of it or something like that. So anyway, yeah. But yeah, A Little Bit Ugly is cool. It's always great when Jimmy jumps up there, and that we've done that not so long ago. Actually, when we played that benefit thing for Jimmy in the park.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I was actually there. I was in the audience with all those other oldies.
That's funny. That was such a fun show. It was really embarrassing. We bumped into our booking agent there who knew nothing about the show.
Oh, yes. Good for you.
He saw the sign. And he found his way into our dressing room, our buddy Duffy McSwiggin. He's a great agent.
What did he say?
He's cool, you know? It's like there was really nothing. He was sort of like, well, you should have let me know. I could have helped you with this or that. You know, just as agents would do, they want to be part of the action if you're booking shows.
Yeah, they want their percentage.
but there was, you know, this was a bit of a different thing.
Oh, that's why he was being cool, because it was a benefit and he wasn't getting the
exactly.
percentage.
We weren't getting paid. We didn't get paid.
Right. The dressing room must have been in Niagara.
Yeah, of course.
Like, book all the benefits you want without me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny, man. Yeah. Well, someone like Dickie is sort of a mythological figure to me. Is he one of those people that when you first met the first couple times, could you tell it was just a little something extra about the guy, extra charisma? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we, you know, he's a few years older. So those few years, it means nothing now, but when one person is 21 and one's 18 or something like that, it's huge. the first time I met him, there was a show. There was this place called The Club in Central Square. And I can't remember who was playing. But anyway, there was a little parking lot there, and I was skateboarding in the parking lot, and this car like screeched up onto the curb and into the thing. And Dickie was driving at the time. I've known him to, I knew him to finally get his license probably 5 years later. So I don't know why he was driving.
Okay.
But there were some other like real skaters in the car, and you know, Dick was, it was all at that point they were kind of, leaving the hardcore thing behind and starting these ska bands. And, you know, it was a little bit more about sort of having fun, you know, as opposed to like getting your head smashed in.
Right.
At a hardcore show. And, I almost got hit by him, and he jumped out of the car, and then he jumped on my skateboard and tried to skate a little bit. And then you could see that he had, you know, he probably had a few beers in him or something at that time, you know, but I knew who he was, you know.
Right.
Our guitar player, Nate, his older brother, Martin, was kind of friends with those guys. And there were some other parties I went to in high school where he was kind of around with his friends and stuff. So, it's amazing to me, actually, come to think of it, the reason I kind of knew him more was the other band I roadied for. The first band I really roadied for was this band called Chain Link Fence, and Dick's brother Billy was the singer of that band. And so through roadieing for that band, like, me and Dickie ended up hanging around a little bit together. And I don't know what or why, when, you know, me and Nate kind of mustered up the courage, like, hey, we're talking about starting a band, you know. But by this point he had been in a couple bands, you know,
and they were kind of like notable local bands too.
Yeah, you know, maybe more so now than at the time though.
Okay.
You know, like, maybe it's a little more like, you know, because Dickie went on to do what he did, people are a little more interested in, but at that time, sure, it really, you know, there wasn't music out or anything like that, you know. It was just they were having fun hanging out. So anyway, we expressed an interest in, and he said, yeah, you know, why don't you, you know, maybe we'll do that. He moved to Albany shortly after for a little bit, but when he came back, we connected, and I got a job. He got me a job at this place, the Brown Derby Deli, downtown Boston. It was a place he had been working, and I don't know, it was like a hot dog place. And we started hanging out, you know.
Yeah.
And he taught us a lot, you know, like, he knew way more than us about songwriting at that time.
Sure.
Know? And just being a band and getting shows and making flyers, you know, he made all our flyers. And right, me and him we had this route. He lived in, on Thayer Street in Boston, these lofts that I ended up eventually living in too. But, I lived in Cambridge, and we'd meet somewhere along the way with I'd get a big thing of Elmer's glue, and he'd get Xeroxes made, and we would glue these flyers to anything, you know, stationary or not, cabs too, you know. We'd put them on the signs above the cabs and stuff, but mailboxes and posts, and these flyers were up for years.
Yeah, you used Elmer's glue. Elmer's glue. Hilarious, dude.
And because what you do is you do all around the outside, and then you do a big X through the middle,
right?
And then
maybe
a couple extra dots in the little
things. Not going anywhere.
Triangles.
That's not going a stable anywhere. Job. Yeah, jeez.
Yeah. I mean, and we were promoting for shows that were 2 days away. I don't know what we thought.
Right.
How permanent we needed these things to be, you know. But yeah, you know, Dick's cool. He's funny as hell, and he's cool, and he's smart, and he writes great lyrics, and you know, we're dear friends to this day.
It's just been like that from there. Did you, you know, you mentioned it a couple of times, you know, the New York people coming up and the violence of the late 80s, early 90s up there. Did you ever have any epic brawls?
I didn't. I mean, I missed that, you know, 82. I was the first big show I saw was the English Beat.
Nice.
And, yeah. So this was 81, I think. English Beat, REM was the opener.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. Fine. And then, but you know, from there you get into it more. I saw Minor Threat early on, VFW Hall, saw some really good shows and stuff like that. But I was a little timid and maybe a little young for some of it. I was a little bit more of a back of the room kind of guy.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
And so I was, it seemed dangerous to me. And that's probably partly why I loved it so much.
Yeah. Know? So you liked being around that though.
Yeah. But I was by no means was I in the mix on that kind of thing. You know?
Right. Yeah. Right. I was, so we have this segment called Mystery Friend where we try to get kind of like dirt on, you know, from one of your old timers.
Mm-hmm.
And I failed to get a mystery friend for you. I hope that, I was trying to get Chris Doherty. I think is he okay? Heard he might not.
Yeah, I hope he's. I hear he's doing better. Okay. He had a stroke some years ago.
Okay, but I did get hold of John Darga, who didn't have any dirt on you, but he said, he goes, I was never in a brawl in Boston that Dickie didn't start, like at a show.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true. I mean, he's certainly, certainly not a violent guy. I mean, he was like, you know, he was on stage a lot.
There's
a story about Lux Interior punching Dickie or something. I don't know if that really happened. I think maybe it didn't. But, you know, he was always sort of part of the show and a lot of stage dives and that kind of thing. But he, by no means was he ever a guy who was looking for that kind of trouble, you know.
He's in the mix.
Maybe Johnson said that he was involved in all of them. Maybe he didn't say he started them.
Yeah. I don't think he started them, but he might have been.
I appreciate that. I could say the same thing for myself. There's a good like dozen conflicts that I was involved in at shows that I never threw a punch and never got punched.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
For sure. So, Joe, you and I are part of an exclusive club together.
Oh, my God.
Do you know that?
No, I have no idea.
In the Gap Tooth Club. And it's a big deal in my family. So my father had gap teeth. I have gap teeth. He told me the whole time growing up, it's a sign of genius. Don't worry about it. Yeah. And now one of my nieces has a gap and she's wearing it real proud. So this is three generations now.
That's great.
My kids are just losing their teeth. So I don't know. I don't know.
We'll see.
I don't know what's coming in yet. Like
if they come in straight, get braces that give them the gap.
I will. I'm like, I don't want these kids with normal teeth. Their father's got this giant gap and a cry. I look like a fucking jack-o'-lantern these days. You know? But
if you can't fit a quarter in there, you gotta get, gonna have to get the kids braces.
Oh, dude, I can do a quarter and a nickel. What's your size?
Can you get a nickel?
I can get a nickel. Yeah, I got a serious gap.
I can get a nickel, but it's not coming out.
Do you have the issue? Before I get into this thing, do you ever have the issue?
I'm just so excited to know there is a club, first of all, and could you send me some literature?
Gap tooth rockers.
I'm gonna go a step further, Joe. I have a ranking. Okay,
really?
Coming up in about a second. But do you ever get like a chip or like some hard bread kind of irritates the little gummy part in between the gap?
I don't know. I don't really. I feel like the gap's so big that things just fall out of there. You know,
well, it's like I make my kids floss every night, and I literally have never flossed in my life.
You know what? Yeah, it's funny when I go to the dentist and they get to that part. You know, like first of all, the flossing of the dentist is a bit of just a show. Like,
yeah,
we're doing this so that you think it's something that so that you need to do too. But whenever they get to that, the gap, and they have this little piece of floss, like I always have to kind of laugh.
What's that thing gonna do?
So who else we got?
Listen,
David Letterman.
No, okay. I went a step further because I started looking into like celebrity gap toothers, and there's quite a few. Like it's a pretty long list. So I went into musical gap tooth club.
Oh my God.
And I think you're maybe like getting to like 6th, 7th all time in music history. So the only people I could find, Madonna, of course.
Oh, okay.
Extremely famous gap. Elton John.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going Seal.
Oh yeah, Seal.
Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
But then after 4, I'm starting to get a little like murky. You know, we're going into Leanne Rimes.
Uh-huh.
We're going into Flea, but I'm not even sure he has a gap. He might just be missing one.
Oh, no, okay. He's got a gap.
Oh, he does have one.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
You know this person. You know him personally.
Well, no, I'm just I'm envisioning. Yeah. As you mentioned them, I'm like, oh, yeah, they do. You know,
So as I go through this, what do we got? Madonna 1, Elton John 2, Winehouse, Seal, Flea. That's 5. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I personally would put you over Leanne Rimes.
Okay.
In my own musical history.
Thank you.
So I really think I'd like to hear, I mean, people come back at me, but I got you somewhere 6th to 8th all time in musical gap tooth club. How's it make you feel?
Proud.
Yeah.
I'm for sure. I mean, for starters, quite proud. Yeah. Good. But I will point out that there's a whole world of musicians that we don't know about, you know, that we're going to have to, if we're going to take this, you know, like if Guinness is going to be involved in any of this stuff, we're going to need to really tighten up the science. A bit,
sure. You know? I'd love some feedback because I'm sure there's a contemporary element of this I'm missing. Mm-hmm. That's got to be a fact. But there's some beautiful people too. I try to tell my niece, I'm like, listen, like this is not a weird thing. This is unique and beautiful. I'm like, you got Bridget Bardot, you know, Condoleezza Rice, Ron Howard, Woody yes. Harrelson, Anna Paquin, Elijah Wood, Michael Strahan. The list goes on and on. It's really great. So good for us. Did you ever have the instinct at any point to fix it?
I was told by my dentist to tell my parents I need braces. That message never made its way home.
Yeah. Nice. I remember I had the option because like my teeth were evenly spaced. So like, you're not in any trouble, but you could cosmetically get braces. And already I was like, nah, fuck that.
Yeah, right.
And then when I got older, the solution was like actually making your two teeth bigger so they connect.
Oh.
I'm like, what? You said the two biggest fucking front teeth that ever exist.
Wait, they actually like add something to your teeth to make them
bigger?
Yeah,
I think for some people, they'll put like a little extra like fake enamel or like something over that.
That sounds
you know?
Like a problem.
That's bullshit, you know? Of all the things, don't get me started on.
How do they drink stuff. Through a straw with their mouth shut?
Well, how do you drink through a straw with your mouth shut? You don't have one.
I can't.
Yeah. Huh. Well, it's the greatest thing. And also, now that I have kids, the thing I can do with spitting and becoming a fountain.
Yep.
It's very impressive now.
Yeah.
You know, it's starting to go to good use.
There are benefits.
Yeah. Well, high five, Joe.
Yes.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we stray too far from history, can you talk about Thayer Street? Because I was talking to somebody maybe on this show and I tried to like, Thayer Street was like kind of a big deal. Like I remember it to be like, It was all bands, right?
It was all bands, yeah. So it was this these loft buildings in the south end of Boston. At that time, it was mostly commercial spaces, but more and more sort of artsy-fartsy people were getting a hold of these spaces. And they were only heated on the weekdays from 9 to 5. Right. So they were really cold. I actually lived in my room. I actually took over my room in the loft from our keyboard player, John Getches, lived in this, in the room before me. And it was the best room in the loft in that it was an elevator shaft, but with a wooden floor like put in. So the elevator was no longer functional, but that meant two big doors that closed and you could have a little space heater in there in the winter and it would get like toasty warm.
Right.
That's awesome.
The other rooms, and I use that term lightly, were usually made out of more like canvas stretched on, right, you know, wooden frames, or like, sheetrock, or you might see a carpet hanging from the ceiling or something like that as one of the walls for the people there.
Wow.
Was
it like shared bathroom, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, there was a bathroom there. The Dogmatics was, so this, the loft
Dogmatics,
where I lived was,
right. I think I was at the Dogmatics loft. Did they have mattresses on the floor and walls?
Yes. Yeah. On the walls, that was because the practice space needed extra soundproof. I don't know who we were trying not to disturb, because believe me, we disturbed everybody, but, it would have been referred to as the Dogmatics loft. I lived there with, the singer of the Dogmatics, Jerry Lehane, and,
right,
these guys from this band called Last Stand. Actually, you mentioned City Gardens. The first time I went to City Gardens, I was filling in, playing bass in this band, Last Stand. It was the only show I played with them, but they were opening up at City Gardens for 10,000 Maniacs.
Wow, nice.
And we drove all the way down there, and there were only about 20 Maniacs there, actually, but it was a fun show nonetheless.
There was only 20 people at a 10,000 Maniac show
at that time.
Yeah, wow,
absolutely.
People forget that about City Gardens. Like it became widely known as just like a punk and hardcore place, but
there was a lot of stuff.
There were shows there 4 or 5 nights a week, and really varied. They were pretty heavy and alternative too.
Do you know that guy Toby Record?
No.
Oh, I don't know how you would know him, but I just know him from somebody I talked to City Gardens about, who I met up here, and he teaches, he's taught a couple of classes in our program, but he's like a publishing dude who's in some punk and hardcore bands. But anyway.
Well, shout out to Gentleman Jim Norton, who is a listener of the show, who was the dude at City Gardens. So what's up, Jim?
Yeah. And Randy, right? Wasn't that?
Yeah, Randy was the promoter, yeah.
And John Stewart.
Right, bartender, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite a crew.
So, Joe.
Yeah.
I had to ask.
Yes, please.
Ben.
Mm.
Great addition. He's just always been there. Maybe the Boston, right? Yeah. I wondered, you've seen him dance probably, what, thousands of times at this point?
Yes.
I'm wondering, over the years, has his moves progressed? Does he bust out some moves you've never seen and keep it fresh? How much do you see with Ben? How much has he mixed it up over the years?
I don't really know. I don't. I mean, he has his thing, and his thing is so purely his own, you know.
Yes, that's a fact.
I don't think it's changed all that much, but I'll say that I still really enjoy it.
So you never look over and be like, "Ooh, Ben, where'd you get that one from?"
I can tell you it's progressed from the first night he did that, which was at a club called, it was our first show, and it was at a club called the Down Under in Boston. We were opening for this band called Scruffy the Cat. And Ben, we were underage. Me and Nate and Ben were underage. Dickie was old enough at that point. But the rule at the time was that in order for you to be in a bar, over 21 plus show, you had to be in the band. It wasn't enough to be with the band.
Right.
And so when they were kind of like giving stamps and checking IDs early in the night, Dickie just leaned over to Ben and said, say you're in the band. And then when it came time, it was sort of still this overwhelming fear about Ben getting thrown out of the show.
Right.
And so Dick said, just get up there and do something.
Shit.
Hoot and holler or whatever. And he did, he shouted background vocals, and it wasn't as, you know, it wasn't as much of a display as it is now. You know, it's changed a lot. I mean, he was up there on short notice. Let's put it that way.
So you're saying that Ben has been in the band all these years just so he can get into the shows for free?
Mm-hmm. Not for free, just so he could get in at all.
Right.
Yeah, is the way that worked. And, you know, I don't have to tell you guys, you know, when you, I'll try and put this in a way that Brad will understand, like, when you say to yourself early on, like, we'll just put on clown makeup and call ourselves clowns for progress. You don't really like think that through, you know, like, well, are we still going to be happy doing this with this fucking grease on our face 5 years later or whatever? You know, it's never like, there's no like thoughtful sort of deliberation about this, you know?
Right.
Well, you know, it's just like, you know, you don't think about any of that shit.
Yeah, you rolled right into it.
Yeah, you just do
it. It's fantastic. Who knows? It may have, you know, it's your thing, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, my. Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's one of the hallmarks of the Boston's and probably one of the things that people will ask about first or mention first or that kind of thing. Yeah.
You all were like proper tour, like pre-bus, you know, like van touring and stuff like that. Did you ever have to be like, listen, Ben, like you're fucking, you like, did he have to load, unload, pack, drive? Like, did he have to like do that stuff? Cause he wasn't playing anything.
Yeah. Through the sort of height of our touring.
Yeah.
So like in the mid to late 90s, Ben was our tour manager too.
Oh, right. Perfect. Okay.
And so, you know, we were putting in extra time in the studio and on the writing and stuff like that, but he had extra responsibilities out there on the road, you know.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it always, you know, felt like we were a good unit. Everyone was working hard. And certainly what he does has got to be fucking hard.
Yeah. I think so. Cause it's just that
he's burning more calories than anybody except maybe Joe. The kid.
Yeah. Well, you never see anything but overwhelming positivity. You know, that's that's the thing that would be hard. Like, as a drummer, I've always appreciated the fact, like, the nights I'm in a shitty mood, I'm gonna let my hair down, I'm gonna put my head down, and I'm gonna do my job just fine.
Yeah.
But I don't have to, like, some nights I don't have to perform because I'm a fucking drummer, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of pressure, like, to look good and perform and excite a crowd every night. It's hard. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's the same being a singer too, is hard too. It's like, it's hard to find that night off, you know, or when you're fronting a band or something like that. I think it's especially difficult too.
Yeah. I had to learn that over the years. Cause I was always like the ass I would get on any singer I had about a bad show or about like a negative feeling up there or like not giving it your all.
Yeah.
And I think it was Brian the first time who was like, listen, like, I can't hide it, you know? Like, I got to talk to people. I got to sing. I got to, like, be up there. Like, you don't have to. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It is a different dynamic.
Yeah,
you know, speaking of those early touring days, I thought you guys had the best fucking racket that, like, well, you guys had the the Northeast college circuit, like, nailed down. Before you even did, before you even had a hit on the radio. And
We did.
You never had to, like,
it's true.
You didn't even really have to sleep in a hotel, it seemed like. You guys could take off for weekends and play, like, massive shows and then be home in 2 days, right?
Yeah. I mean,
How did you do that? The
Northeast had a lot of those college opportunities.
How did you guys get that, though? Because those gigs are hard to get.
When we in 1991 or 92, around the time of our first record, we did this, we were in a TV commercial for Converse sneakers. It was for Chuck Taylor specifically. For us it was great. It's like, yeah, Chuck's, you know.
Sure.
And so there was a TV ad that sort of allowed us to sort of gain a little bit of attention at that time. And some of the attention that came from this booking agency in the New England area called Pretty Polly. And Pretty Polly, they were like the middle agent for all college shows happening in all of New England or something like that. So we plugged ourselves in on that pretty early on and realized that, you know, there was, you know, there were sort of different types of opportunities that we could look for or take part in. And the college shows could be fun. Sometimes they were less fun, but the thing that they could do is that they, you know, some of those, a single college show could foot the bill for an entire club tour.
Yeah.
Essentially, right, you know,
right. I
just like how many times was so different.
Did before, like, let's face it, did you even go cross country? Did you guys?
A bunch.
You did. Okay.
Many. Many, 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 many. Okay. You know, probably four or five in a van, and right. You know, probably three or four in a bus before, or more. I might be way underselling,
right.
You know. But we were out there a lot.
I just remember thinking, these guys have such a fucking sweet gig. Why would you ever head across Utah when you could just stay here?
Yeah, but you almost had a reputation those days for being proper road dogs, right?
Yeah, I guess so. We there were years we did 300 shows.
Wow.
Our front of house guy, I remember, had a list or something at the end of a year, and we had done 300 shows in a year, and there were years that we did 200 or more. And that was just kind of the way we were going about it, you know.
It makes me wonder, because, you know, one thing I think it's maybe hard for someone to understand who doesn't tour is how difficult it can be to look a certain way, especially if you're like van touring.
Which is why after a particularly sweaty show, and you're touring in a van. Mm-hmm. So there were eight in the band, and we had a crew of four at that time. So 12 of us in a 15 passenger van with a trailer. After a particularly sweaty show, it was best to keep your suit on, especially if it was an overnight drive, because there would be nowhere for that clothing to dry,
right?
You know, where it would be look semi presentable for the next show. So there was a lot of that,
huh?
Like where we would try and like keep our clothes on just to try and preserve our, because otherwise they like get balled up and shoved in a, you know, in a bag or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. I was always I had one hanger for my mm-hmm. dirt wet clothes, and someone had to like sleep right under them, you know. But so I mean, you know, if you were getting picked up with Converse in the early 90s, I'm sure you were already implementing your style at that point. And, you know, I was almost going to ask as a joke, like, where do you get 11 matching blazers for like photo shoots and stuff? But, you know, when did the style aspect of the Boston's really kick up? Because it's such a big part of your aesthetic.
From the very beginning, from show number one.
Wow.
And Ben was dressed too, because we wanted them dressed as our roadie. He dressed, you know, he had a suit on that night too.
So suits show one.
Suits yeah. Show one.
Fuck yeah.
I remember some early shows where we were wearing suits. Dickie was wearing a plaid bathrobe. You know, there was a little bit of that.
Nice.
He got a piece of plaid fabric and cut out of felt Boss Tones. It was before the Mighty Mighty. It was just, we were the Boss Tones, and
yeah.
made a backdrop and stuff like that. And it was all Dick, really, you know.
Yeah.
I think probably his love of Madness, and, you know, all of us loved the Specials and all that kind of stuff. So like, we understood that aesthetic and sort of what it represented, I guess, to
right.
us, you know, or what we thought it represented.
And how did you punk and hardcore kids acquire these suits?
There was a place in Central Square that called Keezer's that had a lot of good used stuff. You know, you could go in there and you could dig through the bins and find stuff. I mean, literally like enormous boxes, and all it is thousands of plaid bow ties. I don't know like how they got this shit or why, but like, we would go to those kinds of places, to the thrift and to thrift stores too, you know, just digging through Goodwill and that kind of thing, you know. There have been times it's been more matchy. There have been times it's been more just kind of plaid nonsense. Nowadays, actually, Ben's wife, Laura, is involved in getting some of that stuff for us.
Oh, really?
Now. She kind of helps out with that stuff. And we have, you know, there are a couple different companies that hook us up with some deals now and again. And we try and, you know, try and mix it up.
That's awesome.
But anything that you see about the Boston's, whether it's album art or t-shirts or how we dress or what the stage looks like, primarily that's all Dick, you know. Some of that throwdown stage, the elaborate stage stuff, we work on together depending on where the ideas are coming right. from. But really, like, he's a really talented artist. You know, he draws. You know, he used to do cartoons that would get published in Boston Rock, which was like, you know, the sort of the Village Voice ish type Boston music rag and stuff like that.
I gotta find some of those. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, if you search, if you see the early flyers, it's usually this character that has horns and a flat top. It's sort of like, it's pictures of Dickie, really.
right.
But that was, those are his drawings and those are his ideas.
So he really had the like aesthetic for it in his head, dude, you know, right from the get.
Everything we do is on the visual side. He thinks about it a lot, and he has a lot of interest in art and stuff. So
it's awesome.
I just stand back and can't wait to see what the things are going to look like in most instances, you know?
Yeah. So when I started doing the research for this interview, you know, the first image that shows up for you now is that very nice image from the Northern Vermont website. And I took a look at your class schedule and the classes you offer. And one stood out to me, that you teach a class called Contemporary Issues in Music Management, which, you know, is it's a nice way to put it. And often on this show, we kind of cover that exact topic because, you know, we're old people trying to get our heads around TikTok and things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, in teaching this class, you know, maybe not specific to management, what do you think are the biggest hurdles or advantages that people getting into promoting music now as opposed to the 80s and 90s have to face?
The volume of music that's available, I guess, is probably the biggest thing.
Right.
You know, like, how do you rise above that sort of the noise of all that, you know, whatever. You know, for us, it was sort of like, is there a label that'll think we're cool enough to give us their stamp of approval and, you know, maybe fund us to go in the studio? And nowadays it's like, my students are making great sounding recordings for free.
Right.
On their laptops and all that kind of stuff. And there's just more. I think that's the challenge, is just that there's so much more music readily available, you know. But I will say that I actually, although I invented the name of that class, I haven't had to teach it yet.
Oh, okay.
Because I had been department chair for a while, and I was able to hire friends and associates to come in as adjuncts, and people have had some interesting ideas about that. Sometimes it can be sort of more touring specific or marketing specific, or it depends. The angle's different each time. And the idea is that students can take it more than once with a change of title and get credit.
Well, let's hammer out the curriculum right now, you know, let's do it.
Dude, if you guys think that you're not going to be repaying this little favor on Zoom come fall, you're crazy. I'm going to get you both in there. You'll see.
So, I mean, that being said, I mean, even, you know, beyond school, just as an artist who's, you know, still existing and putting out music, what are your methods of trying to rise above that noise? Or since it's the Boston's, are you kind of like, you know, grandfathered in, I guess, to like the old ways? Like, do you have to do the things that a young band has to do?
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't know, or maybe we should be and we don't. I mean, we have an Instagram and we have a Facebook and, we have a Twitter that has not been opened for several months.
Okay.
And, I don't enjoy that stuff at all personally.
Yeah, right.
Even though I was the, you know, back in the day, I was the one who started that Facebook, and there was a time when I was kind of like a little more enamored with that, sort of connecting with fans. The time it was most exciting was when we were getting back together in 2007 after we had not played for 3 or 4 years. And
sure.
You know, around the time, you know, MySpace was still around and Facebook was just starting, and like, to be out of touch with fans for those years and then suddenly back in touch and to feel like the excitement, you know, of that first show back or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that's when I loved social media, you know, like, when, you know, we do a special pre-sale thing and it's going to be announced at this time in this forum, and people would gather, and like, there was like, felt like this a live sort of event taking place at a certain period of time, you know?
Yeah.
You know, Boston's, we've always certainly recognize the fact that anything that we're able to do musically at this point or at any point really along the way is by the kind of generosity of our fans, you know? And so, in the early days, we started a fanzine called the 737, and we just made this thing. Dickie did a lot of it, cut and paste, and wrote articles and would, have little like things, question and answer thing from fans. And, that was our PO box 737 in Central Square, Massachusetts. That's where that name came from. And that 737 number is still sort of significant to, the hardcore Boston's fans now, you know.
See, I was TikTok at the time.
I guess so. That was our version of it.
That's your version of TikTok.
But I mean, literally, you know, we're buying stamps and
we're
licking the envelopes and come back from tour, and Dickie would go down to the mailbox and see what kind of mail's there, and we'd answer letters that people send, or we'd send, if they request things, we'd send them a sticker and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so, you know, that's always been like we've been encouraged by those kinds of like connections with our fans. And so in that regard, social media obviously offers that, but it offers so much awfulness now that it's not something that I look forward to doing, opening. I dread it, frankly.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the difficult part about it, is navigating it in a way that's, tasteful for a grown adult.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder, because someone recently told me, they're like, you should have a TikTok. And if you have one, you need to make sure you post every day.
Oh, yeah.
To make sure your feed is feeding and the analytics and the stats are moving the way you need. And I literally just asked this person, I'm like, what the fuck am I supposed to do or say like every day to people, like in a video format? Like, And what I'm starting to realize is there are really people who are just so skilled at content and constant content and making this data, you know, which is really all it is data and analytics now. And that's what people are looking for. And it almost feels like the commodity now is attention, not music, you know?
I get that. Yeah. Sort of maintaining some like position within the general conversation that's going on or something like that.
It's more about like a presence, I guess, just like a constant presence, you know?
Yeah. That's not fun for me.
No, that sounds terrible. Like it does. Like I'm all about like laying back in the cut, you know? Like,
yeah.
I don't want to do all that.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
We were, I mean, I can't tell you how many times we've turned down streaming things over the past 18 months or whatever. Just, I don't know that it just doesn't feel the same to me, or doesn't feel, I guess at this point, honestly, it comes down to like, there's really, especially now, no reason to do anything other than things that feel fun to do, maybe. So maybe we're a little bit curmudgeonly in our assessment of what's going to be fun and what's not going to be fun, you know?
Well, I mean, to me, you know, a band like you, you did the legwork at the time when you needed to do the legwork. It was just a different kind of legwork, you know? And that's where I just feel, I don't feel bad for young kids, because I think this is just what they know and understand, the same way that like when I started getting into music and booking shows and doing bands, I would laugh at all you motherfuckers with like the 8.5 by 11 glossies, you know, that showed up like, I'm like, where the fuck are these photos coming from? They're like, every venue in America was just covered in 8.5 by 11 glossies. And I came like right after that, where I was like, this is ridiculous. This is how you people book shows. What a waste, you know? So
the postage alone, you know,
waste. I'm like, where are you getting the money for photo paper? First off, I'm stealing copies from Office Max, you know?
Yeah. I'm probably too old school in this, in my assessment of like, you know, what's worth doing and not worth doing. I still like try and hold on to the idea, or hope that, you know, the opportunity still exists for somebody to build their thing by packing rooms in their hometown, you know? But now, you know, people, with everything that's going on in COVID. And, you know, 18 months or 2 years in the life of a college student that I'm talking with, you know, like COVID is like a huge piece of their musical experience now, you know, and it's sort of like, it's sort of hard to talk about like, yeah, we'll just like build a fan base and, you know, put on great shows. And that was when I started doing, I did, A&R at Side One, which is probably where the first time I met you, Benny.
Yeah. I think it was
through the Side One gig. And, I saw Gaslight at that first show at the Scene in Glendale.
Oh, you were at the Scene bar.
Of course. Yeah. I was there.
That's all. It was like you, like seven people from Side One.
Yeah.
And my aunts. My aunts, Leslie and Mary, were there wearing Gaslight shirts. They're so cute.
Oh, they were your aunts?
Those are my aunts. Yeah.
We were afraid they were from another label. That was why we went so hard for you guys.
Those are my aunts wearing Gaslight shirts, and we went and stayed at their house after.
But anyway, it was like that time when, like, you know, like, I don't even know, Hollywood Undead or something like that. Like 2 million they called? Like friends on that? I don't even remember. On
the MySpace.
MySpace friends? Were they friends?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But just like crazy numbers like that. And there were a lot of things like that. And people would send us things, tips, or you know, maybe a lawyer somewhere or a manager would check check this out, this band. And at that time, it was sort of like, you know, you'd check out their MySpace was their thing. And, you know, there was a lot of that focus on like, wow, look at all these people who have liked this or who have friended this band.
Yeah, right.
Like that. But it's like, sometimes I'd go and see that stuff and I'm like, but there are no shows booked, you know, or like how many people will pay $10 to see you in your own hometown? And I just have had a hard time like letting go of the idea that that's more valuable or like kind of important in some way that, you know, to be a fan in the physical world as opposed to the virtual world requires more commitment. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like a different level of investment that you'll find with people who are plopping down money for t-shirts and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately what it comes down to is it's like, it's not either or, it's like all of the above, I guess you should
that's
be doing
right.
or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would probably be better advice for people, you know?
Right. Cause I mean, I've even been saying like, listen, like this still has to go back to the art. Like all the content creation you're making has to lead back to something. And a couple people I've talked to recently were like, eh, not so much. I'm like, Jesus Christ, this has gone farther than I thought, you know?
Yeah.
So there's one thing I got to talk about before I lose you, just because it was such a magical thing for me in my life.
Okay.
How did the Clueless opportunity come about? And can you just talk a little about like your experience on like going there and like playing on the set? Like, what was that like?
Well, we had 40 ounces of beer with us. I remember that. Like we,
you know, kind malt or no malt?
It would have been Bud. It would have been Bud us at that point. But somebody made a comment about it, and we said they were sub sandwiches.
it's your steak brown paper bag and
yeah, it's steak and cheese.
Sandwich guys show up.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
There were, if I recall correctly, there were a couple connections there, but the director, Amy Heckerling, maybe knew something of the Boston's, but I feel like maybe the music supervisor might have been somebody that we knew too, Karen Glauber, but I could be wrong.
Oh,
about that.
Karen Glauber, shout out.
Can someone Google that, whether she was the music supervisor on that? She might not have been.
Sure.
I have no idea. I think of her as being, you know, becoming friends around that time. But so for whatever reason, somebody knew about us and thought that we would be a good band to play in the party. And it was an interesting experience for us.
The Google is saying that it was Karen Rackman. Was the music supervisor.
Yeah, Karen Rackman.
Who's got I'm talking Pulp Fiction, Boogie Nights.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, quite an IMDb here.
Well, I had the Karen part right at least.
Yeah.
I remember like they couldn't get the playback loud enough for the for Jose Royce, you know, because he was like pounding away on his drums, and so we were kind of out of sync. And I remember personally being like sort of like agitated by the way the people were dancing. Like I wanted them to dance more. Like, that's not how people dance at our shows. It was kind of like my panic in that moment.
And they were just like, they were what, extras?
They're like, yeah, they're just extras, and you know, they're,
can't you skank?
There's a whole other aesthetic that they're trying to kind of hit that has nothing to do with us.
Not a flat cap in sight.
Yeah, right. And so it was just sort of an awkward experience that seemed to go on for a long, long time. You know, I remember there was at one point me and Nate, the guitar player, were going to be in a scene, an extra scene somehow. Like, it was determined that we would be, we were to be like the extras who were going to the party, the band members that were going to the after party with the guy from the movie. But I remember getting pulled aside beforehand and someone, either our manager and or someone from the production, they were like, well, you need to know that that the character that you're going to the party with is gay, and so that it could be somebody could perceive that you're like, okay. Oh, listen, once I've lived through an 8-hour shoot of people dancing like that to my music, there's nothing you can say to me that's gonna make me worry about doing anything else here.
That's not the deal breaker.
But I just thought, you know, it just seemed like thinking about it now, you know,
yeah,
like,
that's such an archaic thing to say,
sure. Yeah. So it was a wild experience, and you know, ultimately an interesting thing. It's one of the things, talking about teaching up in that music program, I've been there 12 years now. For a long, long time, the one sort of shared cultural reference point that I had with my students was the Warped Tour. You know what I mean? Because like, they would be rolling into their freshman year having gone, and you know, kind of like had a sense of what that was, and knew who Kevin Lyman was, and you know, I brought him to the school one year and all that kind of stuff. But now that's gone. You know, like, the Warped Tour is, it's been enough years now that I don't have students who really have any sense of what that was. But Clueless is always kind of at least there as like, oh, the band from Clueless. Right. Oh, yes, I get it. Yeah,
because that movie's aging into the next generation, I think.
And I mean, it's like, it's it turned out to be like a cool movie.
Oh, it's great.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And how did who pitched the crowd surf?
I don't think anyone pitched that.
I think that was just part of the script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you get a couple sub sandwiches into a long day shoot. You'll find the courage for that kind of stuff.
Liquid, you know? Sub courage.
Yeah, I don't think anyone pitched that. I think Dickie just did that.
Oh, really?
I think so. Or maybe, I don't know. Maybe he cued them in to catch him. I really don't remember. But I don't recall a creative conversation about it. Let's put it that way.
Well, it might have been the thing that brought crowd surfing to the mainstream, because I don't remember seeing it in any other context outside of going to shows before that. Right?
Yeah, well, or Eddie Vedder maybe might have had some part in that. That's, you know,
short time. Pearl Jam videos were before that.
Yeah.
It was close to the same time.
It was after. It was after, probably.
Yeah.
You guys invented it.
Yeah. You guys invented it.
Sure.
So, Joe, before we go, I'm an Avoid One Thing fan. I remember when you did that first CD, and I was like, it's like, it sounded like, okay, this is pretty obvious. He needed to get this out of his system. And I listened to the last one recently. I think I listened to it when it came out, but I hadn't heard it. And it's like, it seems like therapy. I mean, is that like, is it something you got to do? And are you going to do more records? And is there more Avoid One Thing coming?
I don't know. I don't know if there's more Avoid One Thing, but I'm always working on music. You know,
right.
I mean, that sort of like, sort of situation where me and Dickie were writing all the, you know, most of the tunes together for the new record and really hammering away every day. You know, it was like I'd send him something new in the morning and he'd send me something in return by the afternoon.
Oh, wow.
I kind of kept that going, you know. So I mean, I'm always kind of working on songs, and I've already been sending Dick some stuff, and I have other things kicking around. I don't know what it'll be. I love the idea of writing songs with or for other bands is something I've always been interested in, but I haven't really pursued much. And so I have those thoughts. You know, maybe I could do some of that, but the Avoid One thing. Last record was very much so. I mean, that I wrote the songs on that record over the course of probably 15 years or more. There were some things on there that felt like I wanted to get off my chest, I guess you could say. It felt good, and it was a fun project to do. Again, that was another Paul Coldry thing, and I'm still friends with the Avoid folks. It was cool. We had one thing that we never really, and this is probably in part due to the Bouncing Souls, is, you know, we kind of got a little bit more known after the fact because of the Lean on Sheena was the song from the Avoid One Thing record, that first record that they ended up doing. And so I think more people became aware of the band. And so we put that record out, and, you know, we had a cool little packed show at, Great Scott in Boston.
Oh, that place is great.
Yeah, it's great. And we never had that when we were out there before. It's like, we never felt that where people knew the songs and that kind of thing. So we had that, and we were supposed to do some dates that next summer with the Explosion.
Oh, wow.
But COVID.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. We text about playing gigs sometimes, but part of me feels like, man, that gig would be a perfect sort of end to it all, you know, on some level, you know. But I suppose if an opportunity arises and it seems like fun, it would certainly be cool to play music with those people again.
Lean on Sheena, what a great fucking song. Where do songs start for you? What instrument? Are you melody first? Are you notes first? Like what usually kicks off an idea for you?
It's just chords and melody, fake words is pretty much it. And, you know, something like Sheena, it took me a long time to... writing lyrics is very hard. It's much easier for me to write like a catchy melody and, you know, whip together a structure of a song. Won't take me long at all. But to make those noises and notes... make sense in the context of a song, and to write lyrics is something that's really hard for me. And, something that's also really fun about the way me and Dickie work together is that he writes all the lyrics and I write the music.
You know?
And, so I haven't always had practice doing that, but, it's an interesting, you know, it's a different animal to try and write words for something. And it's much more slower, and, I write a lot of bad lyrics in the process, and it's tough. You know, it's tough to come up with 12 songs of lyrics that are worth people listening to. Is a hard thing. You know,
point. Sounds like you have a great partnership. When does how are the horn parts like written and composed? Who comes up with those, and when do they get placed?
It depends. There are some songs on the last record and all the records that I write them. You know, a song like Impression or Rascal King, like those are, I wrote those horn parts on guitar or by humming or whistling or that kind of thing, just kind of teaching. But on this last record, our sax player Leon Silva, did a lot of the writing, and, he is just, you know, whole other level. He's the best musician I've ever played with.
Wow, really?
I mean, and you know, like I played handily.
Wow.
He's a Tennessee kid, so he tours with Justin Timberlake.
Oh, okay.
And he's part of that whole crew, and he plays with some really amazing musicians in LA. And
did the last record, was it the one that had like some pedal steel on it?
Yep.
Who played that?
I was in LA for everything but the very last little bits, and so that would have been a friend of Ted's, probably came in and played on that.
That was interesting.
But yeah, so the record When God Was Great, which came out in May, is the record I'm talking about. And so they come from different places. You know, some of them have been written by other horn players throughout the years. Our guitar player, Nate, when he would write songs, he would write horn parts as guitar licks and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know. Just sort of trial and error and what sounds right. And,
yeah.
And all that. But I will say, like, there's a horn language and a finesse to it that can't really be captured with a guitar or, humming
right.
or whistling kind of vibe. There's just so much more that goes into it. And I have become more and more aware of that, like the difference between an A plus horn player and an A horn player or whatever. Working with Leon, I mean, everyone in our band's fantastic musician, but Leon is a whole other level, you know.
That's awesome.
That's great.
Yeah, he's great. He's really amazing.
And for me, I want to finish up with this just because, you know, you have such a vast experience with songwriting with different bands and, you know, one thing we talk about sometimes on here is when an idea goes from, you know, like the table to the song, like, and when you trust your instinct enough to know that something is good and worth that time. When do you know, and do you trust your instinct more, you know, these days than you used to?
That's a good question. I like the idea of trusting those instincts. And I think that sometimes people have to be careful not to sort of sand the edges off of those initial instincts, you know, because pre-production, there's so many chances to fuck something up
in
making a record. And,
right.
and Pro Tools makes it even easier for you to fuck things
sure.
up too, you know, because like, when is it done? You know, there's just so much you can do.
Yeah. Right.
All that kind of stuff. But I love that. I love when things kind of feel like they fall together and in that way. And certainly there are a bunch of songs on that new record where, you know, they just, me and Dick got them together really sort of quickly, like immediately there was a sense of like, oh man, there's something cool here.
Nice.
You feel it, you know? And so there are 15 songs on that record. You know, maybe me and Dickie probably wrote 10 of them. And there are probably another 10 that me and Dick wrote that, you know, were just other things, you know, that we demoed out. By the time we went into the studio with Tim Armstrong and Ted to work on this last record, I mean, those songs had been recorded in home studio fashion probably two or three times. You know, me and Dickie are always, we're working on the arrangement. We're trying different bridges or, you know, just kind of mucking around with things. So, the instincts is good, but I think it sometimes only gets you so far. And then it comes back to that, you know, Outcome of the Wolves kind of songcraft kind of a thing,
right?
You know, like where sometimes you just gotta, you gotta come up with something simple that it may not knock people over, but it works or it connects in sort of a more subtle kind of way, you know, or something like that.
Sure, sure. You got to trust it enough not to fuck with it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so to try and maybe carry that initial inspiration and that your first initial instinctual idea, to try and carry it as much of that as you can across the finish line, but you know, you have to also be able to stand back and recognize that sometimes there are better ideas in the room too.
Yes.
You know, so that gets into a little of like the ego of, you know, of your idea or the protecting
right.
the idea and all that kind of stuff. And this is where bands tend to struggle a little bit with, you know, territoriality about who writes things and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
Well, you know, having your singer sing into his cell phone might actually be a positive thing because he was singing it into Pro Tools and chopping it all up. You might lose all of the initial vibe that you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah,
that's true. Exactly. I guess you're getting the rawest of the raw take there, right?
Yeah, uh-huh. It's kind of like a handheld cassette recorder.
Believe me, you should hear this shit.
Well, Joe, thanks for taking all that time. We've had you for 90 minutes. That was fun.
Hey. It's great to talk to you. I think you have at least 5 or 6 good minutes of stuff here.
it was great, man. I love picking your brain and getting to the back of this. And thanks for writing so many songs over the years that I love.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's great to connect with you guys again. But I was thinking today, Brad, I couldn't remember Who was the other band or other bands on that tour that you guys did with us?
We did a few tours with you, but were the Shods on one of them?
Oh, were they? Oh my God. That probably. I don't know.
The Shods were definitely like that. We definitely did some shows with them and you guys, which was fucking love those guys.
Yeah, so good.
Do you remember when you guys did, you got inducted to something in Boston and you insisted that Joe Strummer, that you wouldn't do it unless Joe Strummer presented you. It was like the key to the city.
Whoa.
Where do we get off?
Was that what it was? The key to the city?
No, it was a plaque on the sidewalk. It was like the Boston Rock Hall of Fame kind of thing. And it was in front of Tower Records,
right,
which, by the way, only lasted another year or two after this. But so there was Aerosmith had this. It's like a platinum kind of it's a sewer cover. Is what it is.
Right.
With a star in the middle, and there was an Aerosmith one, and there was a New Kids on the Block one, and there was a Boston's one, and we said to our label asked us who we would in a dream world who we would like to present us with this thing, and I don't know who had the gall to suggest Joe Strummer. You know, I was thinking Dino from the Clowns for Progress would have been great. Would have been just great. But it all happened. I mean, somebody paid him probably. Yeah. I don't know.
Flew him in.
But they flew him in and like that. Yeah, dude, there was like, he came in and next thing you know, I was having dinner with him and Bob Gruen and Joe's wife was there. And so there was this little to do on the steps of Tower Records, which is right on the corner of Newbury Street and Mass Ave, which is, by the way, was really like the heart and soul of our flyering, Elmer's glue flyering route was right through there. Newbury Street was the center of that. And so whatever it was, the Boston's, you know, I don't remember it that well. I have a picture of me and Joe in the adult video section of Tower Records together somewhere. But the cool thing was like that later that night, like he didn't disappear, you know, back to the hotel. It was like, there was another event at the Middle East. Oh, we were presenting the Middle East with a platinum plaque. That was another event that night. It was like for the Middle East. And if you ever go to a show at the upstairs in the Middle East, they have a Boston's plaque up there.
Ah, okay.
But so Joe was around for that. So he was around for that and talking to everybody and taking pictures with everybody and being as open and as cool as you would hope Joe Strummer would be. And, you know, everyone, you know, has a story about meeting Joe Strummer and they're all good stories.
Yeah,
you know
what I mean?
There aren't bad stories about meeting Joe Strummer because that's the kind of person he was. Right. But so he didn't, so at the Middle East, but now there's an after party and there's a thing across the street at this like kind of dance place. And now he's at that. And like, you know, and so like people hung out with him until 2-3 in the morning or whatever it was. And like, he really kind of like really embraced the whole experience.
But dude, you're totally leaving out part of it because right after the ceremony, it was all kind of a clusterfuck of like press and all these people who were around. And when somebody came over and grabbed me and was like, come on, we got to get Joe out of here. This is just it's too crazy. And like the Boston's and the Clowns had come up. I think Jesse might've been there, Jesse Mallon.
Yeah,
and
right.
We went around the corner.
Yeah, Jesse was at the dinner with Bob Gruen. I think Jesse might've been.
We went to a VFW and it was like, this like basement VFW and just hung out in there. This was like in the afternoon. That was what I was thinking of, because I just remember Kevin from the Shots like just sitting two seats away from Joe, just staring at him the whole time, like too afraid to even like talk to him. Mm-hmm. But Joe was like holding court. He would talk to anybody. He seemed to and he seemed to genuinely be enjoying it, which was the crazy part about it.
I think he's one of those people who really enjoyed talking to people and like meeting people and stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he was partially Joe Strummer, huh? Knew how to work a room. I guess that helps.
Yeah. But anyway, Joe, what a beautiful guy.
Yeah, for real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're a beautiful guy too, Joe. And again, thank you for doing this. It's really been fun to chat and to catch up and we'll do it again sometime, maybe face to face.
Yeah, thank you guys so much, man.
All right, thanks, Joe. Have a great night. It was fun.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Yeah, I just want to like one thing I need to clear my name of. I never wore clown makeup. I was the catalyst. I was the catalyst for taking that makeup off. Much to Dickie's chagrin, I might say, because those guys had done shows with the Boston's before I came on board. Uh-huh. And we kind of like changed over the whole band. We show up at the first show in Providence, I think it was. And Dickie is having this conversation with Dino. He's like, so you guys, you don't wear the makeup anymore. And Dino's like, nah, we got rid of that. It was kind of gimmicky. He's like, oh, okay. So, and no pyros? Nah, we don't really do the pyros anymore, Dickie. He's like, oh, okay. But you're still like a total wise ass to the audience, right? Dino's like, yeah, I do that, Dickie, do that.
Okay.
He's like, okay.
He was disappointed that
he seemed to be disappointed.
So he asked you to come open and he wanted some over-the-top clowns to show up.
But they took us out again, so it wasn't, he wasn't disappointed. He was
always
down.
Taking yourself so seriously, Brad, you know? You can't just put on a little clown makeup. Are we talking full, like, clown, like,
those
like
guys,
insane clown posse deal?
Yeah, those guys did just, like, full face makeup, and then they used to wear, like white tuxedos.
Did they invent the juggalo?
Oh, maybe. It was
What have we discovered?
There was a rather parallel timeline. I mean, those guys must have started they started doing stuff like early 90s, like maybe like 93.
Who are we talking about? Clowns for Progress
Clowns.
Or ICP
Clowns.
Right now? Okay.
And like ICP like started about the same time, I think. So
did they really? They're that old?
It was a fairly parallel progression.
When did they start? Oh, wow. They started in 1989.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Insane Clown Posse.
Oh, okay.
Credit.
So they got the jump.
So they beat you?
They beat the clowns,
you,
I guess.
I guess you were influenced by ICP then.
I might be misrepresenting, but I wasn't in the band then. That's what I'm saying.
Right,
I didn't join
the
clowns until like 97.
Right.
But
you know what? Another little tidbit I heard in another interview is on the... I think in March, Chris from Les and Jake interviewed Joe and Dickie just talking about Impression That I Get. It's actually a fun podcast.
Oh, really?
And yeah. And, you know, they went through the song, you know, in detail. And apparently the people working on the album had worked on Radiohead Creep. And, you know, the famous, the part in Creep. You know, those people were really excited that it was this like epic entry into the chorus. So when they were doing Impression That I Get, they thought like they needed some like epic entry into the chorus. And then that's where the Dickie scream came from. Oh. That comes like the, ah! And like, and you hear it now. And so apparently that was influenced by Creep, like that's directly.
Right. That's really weird.
Pretty cool, huh?
That is cool.
Yeah, I learned a lot on that.
I got to give some big shout outs here, though, because as we started to say, I really thought I had Chris Doherty nailed down to be our mystery friend. And I should have checked to see. I think maybe he might have just had family in town, but I did hear sort of a rumor that maybe he wasn't in the best of shape. So I'm wishing him the best of health. I hope that, you know, he was just hanging with family, and that was why we didn't get him to be our mystery friend. But shout out to Chris and to Dave Minahan, who was working hard to make this happen, who's also a legendary Boston rocker and a brilliant engineer, producer. Thanks, Dennis, too, and Evan, also, who were trying to make some stuff happen for this.
All right. So everyone needs to, you know, Boston's are 11 albums in.
You can find their information.
Yeah. So, but they are touring in September on the new album, When God Was Great. And they are still great. The record is good.
It's a fun record. It really sounds cool. I love the sound of it. And
So still not disappointing, making good albums. So yeah, go get it. Go see them. Man. Just listen to the Boston's. My personal favorite, Don't Know How to Party, but it's just because it's the first one I ever heard, you know?
Follow Joe at Joe Gittleman on Instagram and, you know, maybe take a class from him.
Yes. Anyone in the Northern Vermont area, look at the class schedule. There's some interesting stuff. Apparently you can be one of the first students in contemporary issues in music management. So,
and avoid one thing. Do not avoid Avoid One Thing. Go listen to Avoid One Thing.
Please don't. Please don't.
You'll be happy you did.
And maybe rate and review our program.
Yeah, you could do that.
Sexually explicit reviews only.
No, that's not true. Just leave a nice review.
Just leave a nice review. Try to make it sexy. And we have the Patreon. The chat had to be canceled last week. I apologize. It was a tornado, an actual tornado.
It was an act of God. Act of God.
By my house. And we were without power for like 36 hours. And I, you know, the kid who grew up in an apartment was figuring out how to operate a generator in the pouring rain. It smelled like gasoline, but I pulled it off.
Congratulations.
Figured it out. We're alive, you know, you didn't have to throw away our food.
You're a good provider, Benny.
I try. The one problem with me is that I gotta start being happier while I'm doing it. Because I'm such a miserable prick when I have to do it. Because all I'm thinking is, I don't want to do this. You know? So that's the trick. I actually got to be okay with it, you know?
Just think about how vital you are to the survival of that little tribe.
That's sweet. Thanks, Brad. All right. Well, thanks to everyone. Thanks to Joe. Thanks to Dickie. And I don't know. We'll see you next time.